You are listening to a session recorded live at A Quest Beyond the Limits of the Ordinary, held August 10th through the 11th, 2007 in Seattle, Washington. Now to our session.
Thank you very much. And after Rupert Sheldrake's calm and informative lecture, I feel a little nervous up here because I'm Mr. Bull in a China Shop when it comes to lecturing. And I want to provide some information that starts at the basic level and goes up to interesting understandings about how you control your life and why things may not work the way you think they should be working. And this really leads us into a new understanding of biology. Because I speak kind of rapidly, I just wanted to give you this website. You can download free articles about the topics that we're talking about. It's not the talk I'm giving, but on the issues that I will be talking about. You can download articles and references freely off of this website. So I would put that down rather than trying to take a lot of notes to try to keep up, because I don't think your hand moves as fast as my mouth. And there's an issue about that. This is one of the I Chings, and I pulled this once in a reading, and I found it to be so important I wanted to keep it, because it talks about a returning. And it says that after a time of decay comes a turning point. Well, we're really approaching that turning point right now, because the decay is manifesting right in front of us and causing us great concerns. It says that the powerful light that has been banished returns. That powerful light, that the way I see it, is actually spirituality, which in a sense has been banished by science, is going to come back in, but in the context of science, so it's going to return. And what's the beautiful part about it is, as in the last line, it says there's movement, but it's not brought about by force. And why this is relevant to me is that I think we're on the edge of an evolutionary platform right now, that we're jumping into a new evolution. And the relevance about that is that it will not require us to be in battle, to fight. It's a changing of our consciousness, of our belief system. As we change that belief system, the world will change right along with it, and it doesn't require that force. So I get very excited by this, because I think that we're going to feel these changes manifest within the next 4 years, that something will start manifesting, and the world is going to be profoundly different. I really hope so, because I really understand that we are moving in that direction right now. But to bring this to you, I want to talk about the fact of what was holding us back from this evolution that we really would like to get into. And what we talk about in this lecture, I'm going to talk to you about how perception controls your life. And why that's important is because when we deal with what we call myth perceptions, the myth perceptions that we have bought that are taking us off course, that these are being corrected, and as we understand the new beliefs about these topics, we will then be on our way to a higher level of evolution. Myth perception number one, biological processes employ Newtonian physics, and this is the physics that deals with the material world and ignores the invisible world. Well, this is going by the wayside, because we're beginning to really understand from the quantum physics people the nature of the invisible fields around us, and I'll be talking about that. That myth perception number two I very specifically get into is the concept or belief that genes control biology. This is totally false, yet you can go out and read a newspaper or watch a TV show today and still get the news that this gene controls that and this gene controls that, and that you become a victim of your genetics. And this is an issue that is totally false. You are the master of your genes, and you can rewrite any gene that's in your body right now and change its expression just through your living and your consciousness on this planet. So you are not a victim of your genes. Myth perception number three is a connection with the evolutionary belief of survival of the fittest. And this leads us to a competition, and the whole world's based on competition because of a belief of a necessity of a struggle in the survival of life. It turns out this is totally false, that evolution is not based on competition. Evolution is based on cooperation. Well, that's 180 degrees away from our belief system. And what we really have to recognize, instead of fighting each other on this planet, is coming together to recognize something that I hope at the end of this becomes clear, and that is this. We're evolving, not as individuals. The individual's not evolving. It's humanity that's evolving. That we are cells in a body of something larger called humanity. We've done our evolution, but it's the whole society as a unit called humanity that is in the process of evolution, and it's based totally on cooperation. And this becomes evident as we'll talk about it. And the last misperception that is really leading us aside is that evolution is a random process. And this is the belief that conventional Darwinian theory, or actually I should say Wallacean theory, because Darwin actually plagiarized it from Alfred Wallace. And the issue about that, why is it important, is that if you buy into the belief that evolution is random, and then you say, so what is the purpose of human existence on this planet? And the answer is, well, there is no purpose. If you got here by accident, how could there be a purpose? And the reality is, there is a profound purpose for us to be here. And without realizing that purpose, which was understood by ancient people, that we live in a garden, and we are the gardeners. And what we have been doing without this awareness is destroying the garden. We were put here as a very pivotal element in the control of the garden. And how can I say pivotal element? And the answer is, because look what we're doing in destroying the garden as it is. So if humans can change the planet that way, then we're at some very relatively important level in sustaining this garden. And misunderstanding that is causing us to destroy what provides for us in the first place. These four myth perceptions, when corrected, will lead to a completely different world and a much more healthy, holistic, and a loving world than the one we have right now. But to begin with, I want to talk about cells, and I mentioned this last night. And the important point about this is that while I told you that each one of you perceives yourself as an individual, this is itself another myth perception. You are not an individual. You yourself are a community of cells. It's the cells that are living entities. You represent the collective community. So you, a human body, and your life is really collective amoebic consciousness, that you are, you know, really like 50 trillion amoebas living under your skin in a world where every cell has every function that you have. Very important to know this, that there, every function in your human body is already present in every cell. So in a real, true understanding, cells are miniature people. They live in their world the same way that we live in our world, using the same mechanisms that we use to live in our world. And why that becomes important, then you start to recognize that your body is a community, very large community, in fact. But what's really important about this community is that there's a government. And if your government, you have a good government, your mind, then your body will live in harmony, and you could have 50 trillion cellular citizens all blissed out at one time. Unfortunately, if your government is like our government, then you're going to have pathology inside your body like we have pathology in the country right now. And it's a connection. It's not a coincidence that the fear and the mismanagement of our government is leading to illness and pathology at a rapid level that's creating and precipitating a vast health crisis, which actually could kill us. So we want to talk about your government. And then we're going to talk about, hopefully, how there's the invisible government. And that invisible government, just as some of us talk about, is running the show. Well, your invisible government is running the show. And if you're not aware of that government, then you're going to find problems, because you may have great intentions and desires and wishes that you want something from this life. And if you don't realize it, then there's a tendency to say, well, the universe isn't supporting me because I have all these great things that I want and it's not coming my way. And so we look outside of ourselves to see where the problem is. And I will show you, hopefully by the end of this, that you didn't have to look outside to see where the problem was. You have to look inside to see where the problem is, because the invisible government will lead you to ruin, and it operates without you even being cognizant of it. So that becomes the hardest part, to understand why your life may not be going where you want it to go. And talking about science, it's very important to recognize that we talk about all these different disciplines, biology, chemistry, physics, and all that. And what's interesting is that every science is connected to every other science. They're not separate individual entities. And science is actually built like a pyramid with several levels to it. And if I would start to show you the building of science, I would put on the first floor of the building is mathematics. And as Rupert talked about just a little while ago, he said, you know, he talked about that God in mathematics, that mathematicians put God into the mathematics itself. It's the foundation. From mathematics, then you could lead to the next science, which is physics. And then from physics, which is the mechanisms of life and the mechanisms of the universe, physics means mechanics. That's why you can say quantum physics or quantum mechanics. Newtonian physics, Newtonian mechanics. It's mechanisms of how the universe operates. So physics is fundamental to all the other sciences. From physics, you can then start to study chemistry, which is the mechanisms of the material world and how they interconnect. There are all different branches of chemistry, and as you get up the level of chemistry, you start to recognize there's a biochemistry, an organic chemistry, which is the precursor of the next floor called biology. And then from biology, there's an additional science built on top of that, which is psychology. Why I want to present this, and it's a very important understanding, and it goes like this. If a science on a lower tier changes its belief system, every other science above must incorporate those beliefs or they're not scientific anymore. And this becomes very critical because when we look at our building, the world that we're living in today in the conventional world of medicine and biology and all that is really based on a physics that is called Newtonian physics. And why this becomes relevant is simply this. Newtonian physics is a belief based on a materialization of the universe that we live in. And how do we come about this? Well, we can go back in history and talk about, well, Isaac Newton came into a world where there was a belief of possibility that the universe itself was like a giant clock. It's like a machine. And that if you could understand how all the gears engage, then you would be able to predict its movement. And if you could predict its movement, then you could control and regulate the machine. This was a belief, and actually was seeded by René Descartes, in fact, that the concept that there was a celestial mechanism, but it was left up to Isaac Newton to define celestial mechanics. And what he did was this. First, as Dr. Sheldrake emphasized, he created a math. Before he could do physics, he created differential calculus. And then with that differential calculus, he looked at planetary bodies moving in the solar system. So he put this information into an equation. And what information did he put in? So in studying the moon moving around the Earth, he put in these three fundamental factors. The physical mass of a planet, gravity, which at that time was connected to the physical mass. So gravity was a physical character. Something that's bigger had more gravity, so it was connected to the size of it. And the acceleration, and he puts this into his differential calculus equation, and he was able to accurately predict the movements of the universe in regard to the solar system. Well, why is this relevant? Because science is based on prediction. So since he was able to accurately predict it to that extent, then it became the science of how the universe worked. Yeah, but why is this relevant? And the answer is this. Where is God in the equation? Where are invisible forces in the equation? Where's the field in the equation? It's not there. It's all really based on the physical reality. Are you going to remove that? I would appreciate that. Thank you. So why is this relevant? Because when Isaac Newton put all this together, he created a world that you can understand without invoking God or spirit. He said, you want to understand anything? Just study the physical reality. So the net result of this is the conclusion that the universe is a machine, which means that everything in the universe is a machine as well, so that we live in a mechanical universe based on this belief from Newton. And it's based on materialism. Focus on the physical things and don't worry about the invisible spaces. Nothing in there is of relevance to understanding the world that you live in. So we bought this. But as I said, Descartes came up with some ideas beforehand. One of Descartes' ideas is he came up with, yes, there's a body, but then in his Latin he wrote, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, which gave us the foundation of what he talked about as a mind. So we came up with a mind-body duality at the time of Descartes. But by the time that the physics was finished with Isaac Newton, a whole difference came about here for the following reason. Because in a world of Newton, you separate the mind as a vital force from the physical reality. And then in Newtonian physics, what you essentially do is you eliminate the vital force, because Newtonian physics is based on matter only. And when you eliminate the vital force, you eliminate the mind from actually participating in the unfoldment of the body. So ever since the time of Isaac Newton, conventional science has disregarded the mind as a relevant contribution to the expression of the physical body. And it was interesting because before I left Stanford in 92, when I was writing my last paper at Stanford, I actually started to include about a mind-body duality and talking about receptors and the brain and all that stuff. And you should have seen the abuse that my colleagues gave me, the concept of something so unscientific as mind in a scientific paper, they made me throw the whole concept out of the paper because it was not scientific to introduce mind into the science. So we leave that out, and unfortunately, that's their issue. And so fortunately, you're here because you got far better thinking in your mind than they may have in themselves in this regard. But you leave out the mind, you're left with this physical mechanical machine because if everything in the universe is mechanical, that includes life as well. So we look at the human body as a machine as well. That means if you want to understand the human body, you would understand it the way you understand a machine. Take it apart, look and study all the pieces, see how they engage with each other, and when you have a survey of all the parts and pieces, then you will know, understand how the mechanism works. Well, this is the nature of what biology did. It said, let's take this thing apart. The first thing you find out that you're made out of cells. Okay, so now we got this 50 trillion cells. Yeah, but how do they work? Well, simply, here's how they work. They work very much like this image. They work like gears, so that if you can imagine these gears moving like that, in fact, you can move better. The fact is, how does the cell work? Engaging gears. And as the gears move, they actually create the functions, respiration, digestion, excretion. So the cells are very much mechanical. And they're gears inside the cell that carry out the functions of life. They're designed to interact and create all the characters of life, growth, and all the functions inside the human body. The gears inside the cell are proteins. So right away I can tell you, I can take the cell apart and then look at its pieces, and the pieces, the primary pieces, are called proteins. There are over 150,000 of these proteins. The proteins are the gears. And each protein has a different structure and a different shape and involved with different functions. So a cell is made out of over 150,000 different little gear parts called proteins. They're like gears in this. I could take the gears, put them in a test tube, and have the functions in the test tube. I can show you digestion in a test tube by getting the digestive proteins out. I can show you respiration in a test tube by just taking the proteins involved with respiration, stick them in a test tube. Muscle contraction. I can actually show you the muscle contract by just isolating the proteins involved with muscle contraction. So essentially, all the functions of the cell are navigated by these gears that interact with each other inside the system. The relevance is each protein has a unique shape. So I am now going to do my standard 5-minute protein biochemistry course. And what's really neat about the protein biochemistry course is this. There are 150,000 different proteins, but rarely can you say all proteins or all of anything behave this way. Well, let me tell you about proteins. All proteins are made out of linear strings of subunits all put together like poppet beads. The subunits that make up proteins are called amino acids. So when you go to the health food store and you're looking for amino acids, what are you making? The backbone of the protein, and they're like poppet beads. They plug into each other. There are 20 different amino acids, and here's where my model falls apart. If you look at this model, all the little beads look exactly the same except for different colors. But the amino acids have different shapes. So there are 20 different little shaped pieces that make up the backbone of the protein. And they plug into each other just like these gears. So if I show three different shapes, just to, you know, show three different amino acids, first quiz, how many total different shapes are there? 20. So I'm only going to show you three. Here's the amino acid with a 90-degree bend. Here's an amino acid with a 45-degree bend. And here's the yellow amino acid that's straight. Three shapes out of a potential of 20. And how do they work? Well, they plug into each other just like poppet beads. And these are called peptide bonds. These are bonding together. And as a result, these are creating now a linear chain of poppet beads. But as you notice, in my particular case now, the individual units are not all the same shape. So as I start to assemble them together, the backbone takes on a three-dimensional structure based on the shape of the individual components. So here's my backbone for this piece of the protein. The shape on this backbone is due to the sequence of the amino acids. So if you understand it, then you answer this question. I say, if I disassemble the sequence and reassemble it in a different sequence, will I get the same shape, yes or no? So the nature of 150,000 different proteins is based on the fact that each protein has a unique sequence of amino acids when assembled, gives the protein a backbone, and that backbone is responsible for the shape of the protein. So in my three models of proteins up here, underneath that calm exterior, inside is a backbone that gives the ultimate shape to the protein. And I tell you, well, what's the backbone? A specific sequence of amino acids, 150,000 different ones of these, okay? So these are the building blocks that make up the human body and make up the cell. Well, how do they work? Well, this is an image of an old wind-up watch, and I say, in your mind, can you imagine if this thing was working, that this gear, as it turns, would turn this gear, and as this gear turns, it would turn that gear? Can you imagine that in your head, yes or no? So I said, well, instead of all metal parts made by humans, what if I blew up the proteins large enough to make them gears? So instead of metal gears, I make protein gears. Now I ask you a question. In your imagination, can you imagine that when this protein turns, it moves this protein, and when this protein moves, it moves that protein? Can you imagine that? So you can see how a protein machine could work. And I said, yeah, but this is a protein metal machine, so I throw away all the metal parts. And I say, can you understand that if these proteins start engaging, they act like gears and they create a function? And now what we're down to is a protein machine. Inside the body, 150,000 different proteins are grouped into different gears assemblies. The different groupings are called pathways, which means, let's say, if I said a digestive pathway, would that invoke any thought in your mind? And I hope it would invoke this, a group of protein gears that when they engage create digestion. Well, if that was a hard one, let's see if I get a better one. Respiration pathway. What do you think that might entail? A group of proteins that engage and do what? Respiration. Okay, for those that are still not there, one easier one. Muscle contraction pathway. Again, what does it say? That you get the right proteins, put them together, and they move, they create muscle contraction. So the functions of your body are due to the gearing action of the individual proteins coming together in assemblies called pathways. Here's a picture of Charlie, and he gave us an idea about what controls the body's functions. And he did this because in working with breeding animals, which was a pastime in those days before television, people were breeding plants and animals for entertainment. And one of the things they found out, which was obvious to everybody, was that the traits of the parents were generally passed on to the offspring. Well, all of a sudden, they wanted to know, well, what controls your traits? And they said, whatever controls your traits must have been passed to you from your parents. Well, since the sperm and the egg come from the parents, and since we lived in a Newtonian world that said focus on matter, then it became obvious that whatever controls our traits must be present in those sperm and eggs passed from the parents that are then expressed in the offspring. So that gave everybody the direction of where they should go and look for what controls life. And in that process, it took about 100 years before we came to the story of the DNA. And the DNA, the double helix, everyone is familiar with that, recognizing that this helical structure with like the staircase going up in the middle here, these are made out of what are called DNA bases, and there are four different ones, but the sequence of the bases, as indicated in color here, the sequence of the bases, guess what they do? They tell me the sequence of the amino acids, so that the DNA is a blueprint of how to tell me which amino acid comes after which amino acid after each one. So the DNA is a physical blueprint that controls the synthesis of the proteins. But then the next question in their search was, yeah, but what controls the DNA? And here's where the whole thing went wrong. They isolated DNA, and they found that they could separate the helix so that they could separate the two helices of the DNA. And when they do that, they end up with a single helix. And then they take that single helix and put it into a beaker of building blocks of those little ATCs and Gs of the DNA. And they put it in, soak it in there for a little while. And when they pull it out, lo and behold, the DNA recompleted itself as a double helix. Every time you split the helix into individual helices and just put a single helix in, the DNA will act as a template to make a perfect complement to create the other helix. So they was like, oh my God, DNA controls its own reproduction. And they figure, now we got to the end of the line. DNA controls the proteins, and DNA controls itself. So all of a sudden, this is where the traits come from. This led Francis Crick, co-founder of the DNA story with Watson and Crick, to come up with a hypothesis that is called, believe it or not, it is called the central dogma. As you can see, I illustrated like the Ten Commandments because it is the Ten Commandments of biology. Everything was premised in biology based on this. You are the protein. This is you. Yeah, but you say, but where did the protein come from? Because the proteins give you your traits. The proteins give you your physical traits. The proteins give you your behavioral traits. So you're a protein mechanism. Yeah, but where did it come from? Well, you follow this back up to the top and you see that it came from the DNA. So the central dogma is a belief that your life is coded in your DNA, and so at the moment of conception, you've got programs that will determine the character of your proteins, which in turn determine the character of your physical and behavioral life on this planet. And this all of a sudden becomes interesting because the information you can see flows in a singular direction by these arrows. It only in the central dogma flows from DNA to RNA to protein. So I say, where did you come from? And you go up the arrows backwards, and your source is DNA. And the relevance about this is that the central dogma, which is what it's called in the textbook, it's also called the primacy of DNA when they talk about it, with primacy means first cause. You tell me about an issue in your life, I'll tell you about the first cause. Must be the DNA. Exciting part to me is, unlike Rupert's story about anecdotes, I myself taught the central dogma for years. It was only after I left the university that I paused long enough to say, what's the definition of the word dogma? And when I looked it up, I was shocked. I mean, totally shocked, because here's the definition. A belief based on religious persuasion and not scientific fact. And all of a sudden I realized, my God, for all those years I was teaching religion and this belief, because it turns out it's not true at all, but we bought it. And as long as we bought the dogma, then we became the victims of the dogma, that we ended up being controlled by the DNA, and this is our belief, and that's why we're always looking for the Human Genome Project, or the gene that controls this, or a gene that controls that. And so genes control life. That's the whole story behind the central dogma. But the interesting thing about that, then it brings us to this understanding. Your traits and your characters, why you were born that way, was because of your DNA. Now stop for a second. As far as we know, you didn't pick the DNA that you got here with. Right now, we know this. You can't change that DNA. Since the DNA controls your life, and you didn't pick it, and you can't change it, then all of a sudden you start to realize your life is controlled by this DNA. In biology, we refer to this concept called genetic determinism. The genes determine the character of your life. But go back. You didn't pick them. You can't change them. Controls your life. What does that make you? And the answer is a victim. A victim of heredity. Why it becomes important? If you recognize you're a victim, what do you need? A rescuer. The moment you're a victim, then you buy something to rescue yourself. And then now you become a consumer to find out what it is that you can enhance your life, because you got stuck with all those bad genes and you can't do anything about it. And we buy this, and we might need the volume check on this, so I'm going to play a video segment right here. I can't believe it. I saw this ad. I had to copy it and show it to you. It's an ad for Lipozyne. So I'll put it on. Let's turn up the volume, see if it's going to work. This is actually the ad for Lipozyne I edited just to make it a little bit shorter. Unbelievable. Are you going to do it? I can't believe, you see, but how silly we are, because look what they showed was the cause of it. Poor diet, lack of exercise, stress at work. It has nothing to do with you. It's not your fault. We are breeding victims. Every time we breed victims, you have to buy new drugs. And every time you buy new drugs, they create new victims. And if you don't have something, they'll create a disease entity for you. Just wait. Everybody's got a disease entity, and the pharmaceutical company is going to help you work out. Now, the issue about it is, here's where I come into it. I'm teaching genetic determinism. I'm teaching all this stuff. And at the time I'm doing it, I'm working with stem cells. And I started, as I mentioned last night, working with stem cells in 1967, cloning and isolating them. To me, the greatest joke of humor that I find today is this, that we are depending upon the pharmaceutical industry to do research to activate your stem cells. I mean, stop for it and think about it. You think God gave you stem cells only to have to wait until the pharmaceutical company figures out how to make them work before they work for you? It makes no sense at all. You actually all have stem cells. The question is this. Then maybe if you have them and it's not working for you, you might ask why it's not working for you. And it turns out because all of a sudden you are not a genetic automaton, you're very much controlling what happens to your stem cells. When you use these stem cells, we should essentially not be aging very much. We should repair all of our damages when we have tissue and organ dysfunction. These stem cells are available to you. Every one of you right now has embryonic stem cells throughout your body to replace every part of your body, even things that we didn't think were replaceable. We now know that the brain is continuously making new neurons all the time. We also now know that the heart can actually replace cardiac muscle cells. And why this is important, every part of your body can be regenerated with the stem cells that you have already in your body right now. What was my work with them? Well, I isolated these stem cells. And here's two examples of two types of cells derived from a common stem cell. I'd isolate a common stem cell grown in a tissue culture, and then I'd genetically create 1,000 or more cells which were identical to each other. And then I'd take one of those cells, put it in this petri dish on the left, and under those conditions, the cells take on this shape and create the basis of bone. I take genetically identical cells, put them in a different petri dish with a different environment, they take on this beautiful spindle-like shape, and they form these long straps which are formed muscle. And the reality is they're the same genetically identical cells, the only thing that I changed was the environment. So at this point, I started to realize early on in the game that the environment was selecting the action and expression of the genes because you can't say there were different genetics in these cells. They were all exactly the same until the environment changed. I published this in 1977 in our typical way we publish in science. We make words that the average person can't understand, the same way that the church speaks in Latin, so nobody knows what the hell they're talking about. So this is scientific Latin, a fine structural analysis of normal and modulated cells. Why in 1977 everybody was talking about genes, and I'm now looking at these cells you can modify by changing the environment. I didn't have a word for it at that time, but that's what I stuck with, modulated. Then I had an opportunity after leaving the University of Wisconsin, a hiatus. I'm not going to talk about that because that was called your midlife crisis. I survived. But I got a chance to go to Stanford and continue this research. And it was really wonderful because at Stanford, I did the same kind of research, but much more advanced with much greater technology. And I was working with human stem cells, and I get the front cover of the journal Differentiation. Of course, I was really much more interested in getting the front cover of Rolling Stone, but that didn't really work out in my case. I'll be satisfied with the cover of Differentiation. And again, reveal the same thing. And at this point, I started to realize that none of my colleagues were paying any attention to this. Why? Because they were on this like myopic drive toward the Human Genome Project and that genes control everything, and this is an exception, and they just didn't want to talk about it. But as you heard last night, there are no such things as exceptions. That just means you don't understand something. And so basically I realized staying in the university at this point was not really beneficial because we still didn't understand how it worked. This time I at Stanford, to use a much bigger word than modulated, Stanford's a bigger place, so transdifferentiation was explaining this change at that point. But since then, we found out something else, that perhaps genes didn't control life. And it was interesting because when I was doing this research, I had an opportunity to go up to Woods Hole, Massachusetts, which is a developmental biology center, and I had a chance to work with some of the developmental biology experimental material that the original cell biologists worked with up there. And in studying this, I realized something about the nucleus at this place that I didn't understand when I was teaching, and it goes like this. Right now, every textbook that you read about talks about the nucleus, the large red structure in the cell, and its function is in regard to shaping the cell. So we talk about the nucleus as controlling the function of the cell. Every textbook says that. The nucleus controls the function. Why do they say that? And the answer is because inside the nucleus are almost all the genes. The genes are in the nucleus. Since the genes control life, and since the nucleus is the repository for genes, then the nucleus represented that structure which controlled life because of its genes. And well, this is interesting because I mentioned to you that every cell has every function that you have. Wherever I have an organ, the cell has an organelle. Organelle, Latin, miniature organ. And so basically it says whatever you have an organ carrying out a function in your body, a cell will have an organ carrying out that same function in its body called an organelle. So I said, well, what would be the equivalent organ in the human for the nucleus? What would be the human equivalent of a nucleus? Well, the nucleus function is to control the function of the cell. So when I put it back together, of course, the nature of the nucleus is that the nucleus represents the brain of biology because it's the brain that controls all the functions. Well, at that Woods Hole course, I learned something very interesting, which I then later applied in my own cloning studies, and it goes like this. We believe about the brain of the cell being the genes, and I go back and say, look, if you remove the brain from an organism, then by what you observe, and you take that brain and throw it away, the organism dies. That's a given. So the brain is controlling the function of that organism. But then what I learned at Woods Hole was this. If you go to a cell and remove the nucleus from the cell, and it's a process called enucleation, removing the nucleus of the cell, you remove all the genes from the cell, you expect the cell's going to die because the cell is being controlled by these genes. Here's the problem. You remove the nucleus and the cell still lives and all of its functions continue on just as they were going on before. What was the point? And the point was this. Well, genes cannot be controlling the lives of these cells because these cells have no genes. And the interesting part about it, some of these cells can live two or more months with no genes. They're not just sitting there. They're doing everything that you're doing. They eat, they breathe, they defecate, they move around, talk to other cells, they avoid toxins. They're basically totally unaffected by removing the genes. Why this becomes relevant is obviously you cannot then at the same time tell me that genes control the life of the organism when the organism has great control and life but no genes. And all of a sudden, the reality came that the nucleus and the brain were not the equivalent organ systems because the nucleus can be removed and the organism still goes on living. Now you might say, well, yeah, but that structure, the nucleus is pretty large. I mean, it's not there for show and tell. It's probably doing something. You have to say, well, what happened if you took the nucleus out? Something happened. And the answer is, yeah, I'll tell you what happened. The cell could not replace any of its protein parts. And the cell could not reproduce itself. And all of a sudden I go, ha! The nucleus isn't the brain of the cell. The nucleus is reproduction. So the nucleus is the gonad of the cell. You know, and as some of you have heard, I love it, as science is a male-dominated profession, since males apparently think with this organ, then we created the brain of the cell from it. The reality is the nucleus is totally reproduction. It doesn't control what the cell does. So there's a fact, and this is just an outright fact. You start with this fact, and then we start to look at biology, and things don't add up anymore. In fact, it's this. Genes do not control biology. And this throws a big monkey wrench into the whole system in a world where everything is based on genes controlling life. It just doesn't work this way. How does it work? Well, this is where my research led me. We led to the fact that proteins can engage with each other like gears. And I'm going to show you something now. First, I'll show you with my model, and then I'll show you on the video. And this is called the secret of life. And I'm very happy to show you the secret of life as long as you promise me you won't be mad at me when I show you the secret of life. Because if you imagine I'm going to tell you the secret of life, then you think, oh my God, the sky is going to open up and the light will come from the heavens and we're going to know the secret of life. It's not that complicated, so it's not a big deal. So here's how it works. The protein has a backbone like your backbone. It's made out of like vertebrae, which are the amino acids. So imagine your backbone. You can twist it, bend it, flex it, and you can change shape. Guess what? Proteins can flex and bend and twist and change their shape. But then there's a factor, but there's a stable shape that proteins like to be in. One shape preferred over all the others. I'm going to show you two different shapes and ask you to tell me which one do you think is more stable of the two. Before I do that, I give you one more additional fact. Without it, it doesn't work. And it goes like this. The two yellow amino acids at the end are both negatively charged. Okay? Is this one shape one or shape two? Which is more stable? Obviously, because what? Light charges repel each other farther away they are. So I say, okay, we're happy. Now, this is the shape of the molecule, and this is where it's going to be happy, just sitting around like this all day long. Then comes the secret of life part. There are proteins that have structure, and there are these other things which I'm going to call signals. Now, there's two kinds of signals. We're going to talk about the difference in a little bit. Physical signals and invisible signals, the field, so to speak. We'll talk about that. But right now, let's focus on physical signals so you can see it. Here's the nature of the signal. This signal is a chemical that has a very positive charge, very positive. In fact, quantity-wise, there's more positive in this signal than there is negative in that amino acid, okay? Now, what would happen if this signal starts to come by the protein? What's going to happen? It'll attract positive to negative, bind. Okay, what's the charge at the end of the cell here? Protein. And the charge over here? Shape 2 or shape 1, which is more stable? Shape 1. Reason why. Shape 2 was selected before the signal because two negative charges repelled each other. But now there's a positive charge and a negative charge. They're attracting each other, so they pull together like that. Did you see just what happened? That little thing you didn't notice when I was talking? It moved. The secret of life is movement. If you're alive, you're moving, and when you're dead, you stop moving. It's simple like that. And the nature of it is this. If I take this signal off, what's the protein going to do now that I've taken a signal off? It'll move back. So the idea is you can change the shape by changing the signals. And when the shape moves, when the shape changes, then recognize this. Movement is occurring. And what does the cell do with that? It harnesses that movement to do work. So the machinery of the cell is like gears, but the gears move on their own. So you don't need a motor to drive the gears. So we look at this and I say, well, how does it work? So these are my generic proteins. They're like gears. They act like locks because there are signals in the environment, and the signals are like the keys. Different proteins respond to different signals. Now watch what happens. As long as the signal's not attached, the gears don't do anything. They don't do anything, but boom, once it binds, it changes the shape and the gears start moving, and that movement is used to do respiration, digestion, excretion, whatever the function is. Now it stops moving because the signal's gone. If you want this function to go again, what do you have to do? Put another signal back in. As soon as another signal goes back in, boom, it starts all over again. So now all of a sudden you can start to see ahead now. What is it that controls life? Well, the signal and the control of the signal by letting the signal in or not letting the signal in will then determine whether the proteins function. As I mentioned, conventional biomedicine is locked into the mechanical world of Newton. And to them, all signals are the substance of chemistry. And so that chemistry molecules have to be the keys that plug in. This is an enzyme in light blue all around here. And this is like the key slot. And this is a chemical that when it plugs into the key, engages this protein. So the keys are the chemicals. And the relevance about that is then life is controlled by the chemical key plugging into the protein and changing the shape of that protein, leading to the physiology of the system. Go back to our proteins that we were looking at. Recognize that signal 1 causes the annexin to do that movement. That signal 2 causes the enzyme dehydrogenase to do that movement. Signal 3, different signal, causes calmodulin to do that movement. Every protein has its own unique movement, and every protein responds to its own signal. So by selectively sending the signals, I can selectively control the functions of the cell. Now you have the basis of all of how life works. It's so simple. It goes like this. You are protein machines. What causes life? The movement. And what causes the movement? So I have a signal. And when the signal binds to the protein, that generates behavior. What's behavior? Movement. Now here comes the interesting fact. Your behavior is not working just right. And we then call that as a characteristic, a symptom. My behavior isn't working right, so I express what is called a dis-ease. My behavior isn't right. It's not functioning right. Now all of a sudden you realize it's like, well, I can ask you a question. What could be responsible for your disease? And you look back and you have to realize, well, hell, there are only two things that contributed to life in the first place. Got to be one of these. And the answer is either the protein could be defective or the signal could be off. Does that make sense? Well, here's an interesting fact. Yes, people are born with defective proteins. They're called birth defects. But that's far less than 5% of the population. That means greater than 95% of the population got here with a perfectly adequate set of genes to have a wonderful, happy existence on this planet. So if you're part of the 95% of the population that got here with good genes and you have a dis-ease, what can you attribute that to? The signal. So all of a sudden you realize how simple it is. Now we say, well, what are the signals? What controls the signals? How can you have a bad signal? The answer is there's three ways you can destroy the signal or alter it. Number one, the signal can be influenced by trauma. You fall off a stage and you wrench your back and you cause an interference with the nerve signaling going through the body. You've interfered with the signal. If you interfere with the signal, you've interfered with the behavior. That's pretty obvious. Number two, toxins. If you put toxins into your system, then the propagation of the signal can be distorted by the poisons in the system. So your signal can't get to the end point in a proper form. So trauma and toxins distort the signal, okay? But the third one is the most important source of disease and illness on our planet, and it's called thought. And the reason why this becomes important, thought, autosuggestion, which we can just call mind in this particular case, is this reason. There's nothing wrong with the system. It's just sending the wrong information at an inappropriate time. You understand? There's nothing physically wrong. If I just send the wrong information, though, I am misusing the machinery in an inappropriate way in an environment that doesn't support it. Does that make sense? Why this is relevant is most illnesses on this planet have nothing to do with number one and two. Almost all of them have to do with number three, is that you are sending inappropriate information to your proteins and inappropriately leading to their dysfunction because they're not integrated with the world that you're living in. They're just inappropriate signals. And this is the main source of our problem. So then I say, okay, we're sending signals. And I say, well, Where in the cell are these signals being controlled? What's controlling the signals? Because isn't it the function of the brain to control the signals to my body so I can organize all my functions? So I said, yeah, but where's the brain? Well, the first thing we figured out is this big thing in here is the gonad, so that's not the brain. So all of a sudden, the genes are not controlling the signals. They don't do that. The nucleus doesn't control the signals. We're looking for the brain. And it turns out, so where's the brain? And the answer is, it's the membrane. It's the skin of the cell. Makes logical sense for this reason. The skin of the cell is between the inside and the outside. The skin can read two environments, the external world and the internal world. As the environment changes on the outside, the cell can then read that and then tell the interior to adjust its function to meet the demands of the environment. So the important understanding is this. The skin of the cell is the brain of the cell. There might be some people in here who might be thinking, wait a minute, didn't he say that we were modeled after this cell, that we share these things? And therefore, is Bruce up here now telling you that your skin is your brain? And the answer is, of course I'm telling you that. I taught embryology. If you took embryology, you would have known that. Well, how does that happen? Maybe you remember these words from the distant past. Think about it. When an egg is fertilized, it's called a zygote. It divides, and it forms, the first thing is a ball of cells called a blastula. The next stage, the ball of cells sorts itself out into three concentric layers. The layers are called derm in Latin, And the outer layer is called the ectoderm. The middle layer is called the mesoderm, middle. And the inner layer is called the endoderm. These three layers give rise to very specific organs and tissues in your body. Fact, the ectoderm, the outer layer of the embryo, only gives rise to two things in the human body, the skin and the central nervous system is derived from the skin. So you and the cell are very much identical images to each other. Your brain, the cell's brain, the skin, that's where it came from. Well, how does it work? Well, there are proteins we talked about, looking for a key to plug in here, but the proteins are inside a cell, under the cell membrane. The signal comes from the environment and must pass through the membrane to get to the gears to drive them. Relevance? If I can control the passage of the signal, then I can control the gears. Does that make sense at that point? So I regulate the signal using the membrane. Yeah, but how do I do that? And the answer is this. The signal comes from the environment. The proteins provide the behavior, but the membrane has switches. There are switches built into the membrane that read the environmental signal and then pass it on to the cell. And so the relevance is this. I'm going to show you the nature of one switch. I just want you to understand this. At any one time, there may be 100,000 switches on the surface of a cell responding to the environment at the same time. That's where complexity comes from. But how a single switch works? They all work the same. They're all very simple. They work something like this. There's two parts to a switch. There's a receptor with an antenna on it reading the environmental signal. It's built into the skin. Do you have receptors? Name some big ones. Eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch, pain, pressure, heat. Where are your receptors built into? The skin. Okay, again, you and the cell are exactly the same. This is the equivalent of an eye or an ear or a nose reading an environmental signal. For every different signal, there are different receptors. So on the surface of the cell, 100,000 different switches at any one time. The signal is picked up by the receptor. That's what reads the primary environmental signal. Oh, this is a quiz moment. See if you can remember this. What happens to a protein when it binds to a signal? What happens to the protein? It moves, it changes shape. Then if you got that, can you realize this? There's a shape of a protein before the signal, and there's a different shape after the signal, right? So there's an activated or an inactive receptor based on if it saw the signal. Okay, so if the signal shows up, the protein changes its shape, couples to this guy called the processor protein, which then couples to this guy called, amazingly enough, the effector. What do you think an effector does? Well, first, what do you think a receptor does? Receives. What do you think an effector does? Makes an effect. What does it do? It sends a signal into the cell to go to those proteins and control the function. So the function of the effector, when activated, is to send a secondary signal into the cell that engages the protein and turns it on. So you have 100,000 switches. You control 100,000 different functions inside your cell using these protein switches. Okay. How do they work dynamically? Let me show you. The receptor on the left with the antenna. The effector is over here. And here's what happens. Before there's a signal, there's nothing going to connect these two. Here comes the connector. The connector is called a processor protein. Look at the shape. Look at the shape. They don't match. So I can't connect the switch yet. But when the primary signal comes from the environment, it changes the shape, activated shape. This couples to this, and when that happens, it causes this to open up and send a signal, and this is the signal that goes into the cell to engage a protein. Does that make sense? It's a switch. When that signal goes away, this protein will reset, and the switch is broken. Does that make sense? So watch it again, just one more time. When the signal shows up in the environment, it allows the coupling of these things. These can't couple right now, incorrect shapes. The conformation is wrong. The signal shows up, changes the shape, allows this to couple to this, which causes this to change shape, and it does so by opening up, sending a signal into the cell, which then drives the function of those protein gears that it's targeting inside the cell. Okay? The nature of this is now illustrated in new textbooks with all these new diagrams that if you're a biology or medical student today, you have to learn massive numbers of signaling pathways, that signals come from the environment, bind to the receptors, and then the signals go inside the cell and connect all these things and ultimately activate the cell, creating behavior. So the input signal ultimately leads to behavior of the cell. Change the input signals, change the behavior of the cell. These things are called signal transduction, and this is a new field of biology, studying all the pathways by which signals engage the function of the cell to create life. Okay? So I ask you, what's the name of the switch? And you can look up here. I could give you the Latin name. The Latin name in scientese is called the receptor effector integral membrane protein complex. And all of you are going, yeah, cool. How do you spell that? No, don't worry about that. Let me tell you a name for this switch that is now, it's going to be so personal, it'll make sense. But before I tell you the name, let me ask you a question now. Do you understand what the switch is doing? It's connecting the environmental signal to the behavior, okay? It's a switch, okay? The function of the receptor is awareness of the environment. What's the function of your eyes, ears, nose, taste buds? Awareness of the environment. Yeah, but what's the function of the effector? That sends a physical signal into the cell to engage the function. So I'd say the function of the effector is to create a physical sensation. I define the switch now by telling you, here's the switch. This switch represents an awareness of the environment through a physical sensation, right? Awareness of the environment, the receptor, engages the effector, which then sends a physical sensation. The switch, awareness of the environment through physical sensation. Go to the dictionary, and there's that beautiful word, perception. Definition? Awareness of the elements of environment through physical sensation. What controls your behavior? Perception, because the switch turns it on and off, but the switch is called perception. If you see it, it will turn on the function. Perception is what controls your behavior. Well, how can I say that so clearly? Because behavior represents the action of the proteins, respiration, digestion, movement, excretion, nerve function. I don't care what it is. Those are behaviors. What do they represent? Movement of proteins. Yeah, but what caused the protein to move? The signal. Via what? The switch. What's the name of the switch? Perception. Perception controls behavior. Okay? Now, the interesting aspect about it is that's the first conclusion. Perception controls behavior. But here's the interesting part. All the proteins may not always be present in your cell. Sometimes proteins break down. You have to replace them. The question is, so where do you get the new proteins from? Why I'm bringing this in right now is we just talked about how a cell works. Did we talk about DNA? No. The whole world's revolving around DNA controlling life, and we just showed you how life worked. DNA wasn't even in the story yet. What's the role of DNA? Ah, if I need a protein, I need a blueprint. That's how it works, okay? So where do I get the blueprints? Well, I go to the nucleus of the cell, and I open it up, and there are the chromosomes. You all heard of chromosomes, right? You get 23 chromosomes from your mother, 23 from your father. What do they represent? They represent DNA, 50%, and 50% protein. Well, the DNA is a hereditary material. What do you think the 50% protein is? And the answer is, for 50 years, nobody knew. You know why? Because they were so excited in finding the DNA that when they'd open up the cell and take the chromosomes out, they separate the protein from the DNA, save the DNA for the experiments, and throw away the protein. For 50 years, they threw it away until finally somebody said, you know, 50% of the nucleus is protein. It's got to be doing something besides space filler. What is it? Here's where it is, and here's why it's important, and here's why I'm going to emphasize it right now. I'm going to tell you a fact. It's clear and it's beautiful. I'm going to explain the operation of this right now. And when the public understands this operation as a way of life, it will change civilization. And this is how important it is to understand what I'm going to show you. It will change civilization, I guarantee it. Because here's how it works. How does it work? Well, a chromosome is a core of DNA surrounded by a protein sleeve. What's the DNA? The blueprints to make the protein. What about the protein sleeve? Well, that covers it up. So imagine my arm as a chromosome. My sleeve is protein. Underneath my sleeve is DNA. If I took a magic marker right now and did the code, let's say the genetic code for blue eyes, I'd write out all the A, T, C's, and G's of the genetic code, and I'd write it out so you could read it. And I'd hold up my arm and I'd say, can you read the gene for blue eyes, yes or no? That's the question. And I say, yeah, but what does it look like when it's back in the nucleus? Oh, it's not isolated DNA like the experiment. Back in the nucleus, it looks like this. Can you read the gene for blue eyes, yes or no? If you want to read the gene for blue eyes, what do you got to do first? What's the sleeve made out of? What causes a protein to change shape? Okay, now let me show you this thing, because this is called epigenetic control. You and I, what I was teaching was called genetic control. What does that mean? Genetic control, control by genes. But this is called epigenetic control. What does that mean? Epi is a prefix that means above. Like epidermis is the layer above the dermis. Epi means above. Well, if it means above, then read this. Control, say the word, above the genes. The genes have no control. The genes are blueprints. Think about it this way. Go into an architect's office. An architect's working on some blueprints. And then you lean over the architect's shoulder and say, excuse me, is that blueprint on or off? And they, on or off? What are you talking about? Well, we talk about genes being on and off, don't we? And the fact is what? There is no on and off to a gene. That is fallacious. A gene is a blueprint. It has no on or off or no self-actualization. Because we always talk about genes turning on and genes turning off. We use this every day. Do genes turn on and off? No. Why? They're blueprints. The question is this. When you have a blueprint, it's not whether the blueprint's on or off. Is, are you reading the blueprint or are you not reading the blueprint? And it's not up to the blueprint to determine that. Blueprints have no lives of their own. If they did, that architect doing that blueprint could go to a building site, throw the blueprints in the lot, drive away, come back 2 months later, and the building would be there. But that's what we think about humans. Throw the genes in the system, come back 2 months later, and there's something going. Reality is, no, it doesn't work that way. We bought the story. It is totally incorrect. It does not work that way. The central dogma is failed and flawed beyond any belief. It does not work that way at all. How does it work? Oh, signal transduction. Look what it shows now. That the inputs come in from to the receptors, then they pass through the cell in a signal passing way, and guess where they end up? Some of them. The nucleus. And what's in the nucleus? A chromosome with what? DNA core surrounded by protein sleeve. Where do the signals hit? The proteins. They don't touch the DNA. So how does it work? The output from this input, how does it work? I'll show it to you in a video, and then you can see it for just how a gene works. This is exactly how a gene works. Chromosome, linear strand of DNA broken up into segments called genes. At each gene segment at the beginning, there's a special protein called a regulatory protein. Great name. Regulatory protein. It must regulate something. Yep. Regulates the reading of the gene. How? Well, let's watch this in a nucleus. And here comes a signal from the environment sent through that signal transduction pathway. It couples with a protein because of lock and key complementarity. It selects which protein and which gene is going to be activated. When the protein changes its shape, it pops off the DNA. Now the DNA is available to read the code. And the cell will send up another protein to make a copy of the code, a Xerox version of the gene. And that Xerox version is called RNA. And the RNA goes out into the cell where it's used as a blueprint to make the protein that's needed. Once I have the RNA, I don't need the original gene. The signal pops off and the sleeve covers up. And that's how a gene was activated. Now, when you look at this, again, let's look at it in the sense of the belief system of the world that DNA is doing stuff. So let's root for the DNA. Okay, DNA, come on, baby, do it. Come on, baby. Come on, DNA, do something. Come on, DNA. Come on, DNA. DNA, hello. It doesn't have its own life. It has no self-actualization capacity. It's simply a blueprint. And it's the environmental signals that determine which genes are going to be read and which are not going to be read. Relevant? The primacy of DNA, central dogma, which everybody studies, which is in all the textbooks right now, says that DNA goes to RNA, goes to protein, primacy of DNA. Only problem is, hey, this is incomplete. What are they leaving out? Well, first thing they left out are the regulatory proteins. Yeah, but what controls the regulatory proteins? The signal from where? The environment. Is DNA now primal in this pathway? No, it's the middle of the pathway. Primacy? Not primacy of DNA, primacy of the environment. It's the environment that you put the cells into that determine what the cells are going to become. It's the environment that you put the human into that determines what's going to happen to the human. That our problems or our issues in our lives are more associated with how we interact with the environment than something inherently in our system. Less than 5% of our people came with defective proteins, so the rest goes to the control from the environment. Now here's a very interesting fact. Using epigenetic control from one gene blueprint, this is an important fact, from one gene blueprint using epigenetics, I can create 30,000 different proteins from the same blueprint. Phenomenal. Why? You're not limited by your genes. You can create 30,000 variations of every gene. You can create anything you want from your genes. They're potentials. You can come with healthy genes and make a product that appears to be mutant. You can create cancer without having a defective gene. You can create it via epigenetics. Now, apparently, looking into it now, very high percentage of cancer is epigenetic control. You didn't get a bad gene. You just, the way you lived your life, changed the readout of the gene and manifested a negative gene. And that's probably in alignment with whatever beliefs that were behind that in the preparation or reading of that particular gene. Interesting fact, you could also come with a mutant gene. Here's a mutant mouse called an agouti mutant. Obviously, it's very obese, got different color fur, it's got diabetes and cardiac problems. That's a genetic mutation. This normal-looking mouse on the right, it's an agouti mutant. What's the difference between these two, genetically identical? During gestation, the mother of this mouse, as it was evolving, was fed those elements which alter epigenetic readout at a certain window in its development. And by just eating these nutrients, it covered up the mutant gene. What's the point? You don't have to be victims of our genes. We can rewrite the genes to come out any way that we want in this sense. We're just learning the mechanisms now to control this. Epigenetics can take any gene and create 30,000 different variations on the gene, meaning you have no limitations. You're completely able of rewriting and changing yourself. Concept? Perception not only controls behavior because it changes the shape of the proteins which generate movement and makes behavior, perceptions also control the genes and change the readout. As you see life, you change the genetic expression to respond to your perception of what's going on in your world and in your life. Well, this is the stuff after I left Stanford and I started to compile it and write a book, of course, A Biology of Belief. And if you read inside the introduction of the book, it talks about chapter 2. And in chapter 2, it says, I lay out the scientific evidence to show you that genes do not control biology. I also introduce you the exciting discoveries of epigenetics, a new field of biology that is unraveling the mysteries of how the environment, nature, influences the behavior of cells without changing the genetic code. Epigenetics didn't change the code. It changed the readout of the code. Code stayed the same. So I put this, what I call chapter 2. This is the whole story about how the environment controls the genes. And I'm working with stem cells, and I write the story about it. And, of course, chapter 2, it's the environment, stupid, which really just says, this is a Bill Clinton takeoff from his campaign, it's the economy, stupid. So we change it for biology, it's the environment, stupid. And I write this book, but now I'm out of the university. I'm out of the university. I lost my scientific credentials. I don't have a white lab coat. And all of a sudden people start saying, Bruce, what the bleep do you know about this? And I sat there saying, you know, at least I had a history of science or something about it. But 5 months after I write the book, an article comes out in one of the most prestigious journals in the world called Nature. And in Nature, there's this article. I'm not going to show you the title right now. What's the article about? Stem cells are engaged in a constant crosstalk with their environment. Biologists are fast realizing. Some of them not very fast. I'm going to tell you that right now. And what's this whole article about? How the environment changes the readout of stem cells and makes them different things. So what do you think they call this article in Nature? It's the ecology, stupid. So I feel very happy that even white-coated lab scientists are figuring out the same answer right now. It's the environment that controls your biology and how you see that environment. If you change how you see the environment, it also changes your life. Now, I'm going to change how you see the environment right now. As I said, we're built this whole premise on a Newtonian mechanism, a belief that the universe is made out of matter and ignore the invisible empty spaces. That's our belief system. Let's see. All right. I'm not giving you a break for a few minutes, right? I'm going to give you a break, and as soon as I cover this section, you will get a break. Hold on. Okay. That was from the 1700s, but in 1925, physicists changed their belief. Physicists said that the universe is made out of energy. And then all of a sudden, that means everything in the universe is made out of energy, including you and I. Everything is made out of energy. That material reality is an illusion. It doesn't really exist that way. And so I want to understand the nature of it. I said, well, energy is equivalent of waves. And so using the ripples on a pond is a good visual image to show you that waves are going through this empty space right here. Well, right now, of course, there's telephone, television, radio broadcasts, all kinds of things going through this room right now, and the invisible thing called the field. They're all around you. The issue that we want to know about is, more important, is what happens when waves interact with each other. Do they interact and interfere with each other? And the answer is yes. When they come together, they become entangled. The waves interact with each other. So the invisible stuff in this room is actually interacting and changing itself right now while it's being presented to us. Relevance? If you want to understand what's going on in the world with the new physics versus the old physics, here's the difference. The old physics, just study the pieces, the parts, the little gears, and you'll understand what life's about. But you can't study that way. That's called reductionism. You can't do that anymore. Reason? Because you can't separate the energy from each other. I cannot say, okay, all the telephone waves go to the left side of the room. All the radio waves go to the right side of the room. I can't say that because it can't happen. Everything's entangled. Why has it become important? Then to understand any particular event, you can't focus on any one thing. You have to understand the concept of wholeness. You want to see your health? Don't just look at your physical body. Look at your family relationships. Look at your job. Look what's going on in your community. Look what's going on in your world. Those are all entangling factors that influence your health. It's not just inside your particular body. The last bit of science, and I'll give you a break, I promise, goes like this. What happens when waves come together? Well, here's my little story. I dropped two rocks exactly the same size from exactly the same height at exactly the same time, and they hit the water. The two ripples are coming together toward each other, but they're in phase with each other. Both are going up, both are going down, both are going up, both are going down at exactly the same time. I said, what happens when the wave from the left side meets the wave from the right? And the answer is simple, add up the waves. What does that mean? Well, let me show you a theoretical picture. The wave from the left, the red one is moving to the right, the green one is moving to the left. Here's a zone of overlap. I say, what do? Add up the waves. Minus one and minus one is how much? Minus two. Plus one, plus one. These are hard things in the afternoon. It'll work. Point. When the waves are in phase, in harmony, when the two come together, they entangle and they increase the waves. This is power. Why? A simple point. Drop a rock in the pond. A little tiny rock makes a little tiny ripple. Drop a big rock, you get a bigger ripple. The height of the wave is proportional to the amount of energy. So the energy at this entanglement place is greater than the energy of either individual. They entangle, they get greater energy. The two waves are interfering with each other, and they're adding up, so it's interference, but it's called constructive interference. Let me show you the alternative. The alternative is this, experiment. Same experiment, but this time I drop one rock before the other. Why? Because when this hits the water, this one didn't hit the water yet, but when this hits the water a little later, so this ripple is on the way up, this ripple's on the way down. And when this one's going down, this one's going up. They're out of phase. Well, what happens in the interaction? Same thing, add them up. Plus one minus one is how much? Minus one plus one, zero. The net result is two energy waves can come together and cancel each other out. They're interfering, but this one's not constructive, it's destructive interference. Relevance about that is that you've experienced this in your life because you are energy beings, and I'll just tell you when you felt it. Constructive interference, when you as an energy frequency came into a place and met another energy that was in harmony with you, you felt more energy. It's called good vibes. You were walking around that party on your toes. Wow, great party. Look, I met all these wonderful people. Good vibes, extra energy.
Our program continues on the next disc.